Hey everybody, it's Joe Trippi and welcome back to That Trippi Show. We're going to touch on the latest GOP soap opera at the end of this podcast. But first, Alex, we have a special guest today, and it couldn't be at a better time. You know, there's a piece in the New Republic out today that I think sums it all up, and we'll put a link to that in our show notes. But it said that if we lose the fight to protect voting rights, we'll lose everything else. And that's why I'm really glad that Mark Elias is with us today. Mark Elias served as the general counsel for Hillary Clinton and John Kerry's campaigns, is the founder of Democracy Docket, an advocacy group protecting the right to vote around the country. Mark, it's just a critical time. You know, I wanted you on the show before, but I think today just seems in a lot of ways more critical than ever. I'm glad you're with us.
Thanks for having me.
Set the table. What in your, you know, after we go through the election, the insurrection, everything, and all the battles, I mean, 64-1 against Trump in court that you were involved in. Where are we now? I mean, there was this big sense of relief that we somehow got past the big threat to democracy, but it just seems to be ongoing.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's gotten worse. You know, 2020 was a threat to democracy because Donald Trump was an authoritarian president who didn't respect the rule of law, democracy, or democratic institutions. But for many of us, I think we hoped that with the end of Trump being president, the fever that gripped his party would break as well. But that hasn't proved true. And let me give you a way to think about this. In late December, the state of Texas went to the Supreme Court in a failed effort to throw out the election results in four states. Now, it was a frivolous effort by an indicted attorney general of Texas. So you would have thought it would have attracted very little support or attention. It was immediately joined by 18 other Republican state attorneys general. And that worried me quite a bit. Because it suggested to me that this this anti-democracy movement had really spread further than I thought. But then 126 members of the House of Representatives signed on to that same effort. Okay, so keep in mind that number, 126. Then you fast forward 2 weeks to January 6th, and now there has been a bloody insurrection in the U.S. House of Representatives. People have been killed. Police have been dragged down the steps. There has been mayhem in the chambers. And it comes to a vote on the certification of the election. And 139 Republicans voted against certification. So actually, the forces against democracy actually gained 13 votes. So literally, as you go from before the violent insurrection to after the insurrection, opposing the certification of the president gained 13 votes. And that tells you the trajectory that this has been on ever since. Liz Cheney was kicked out of the leadership of the House of Representatives, the Republicans, in a 15-minute meeting during which she was booed by a voice vote. So this is not getting better. We are moving from this being the crazy rhetoric of a failed one-term president into becoming policy of the state in state after state after state as they pass these laws.
So Mark, in the, you know, in the run-up and all those to the election and the mess in between before the insurrection, you saw, you know, what did stand up in institutionally were a lot of local Republicans, Secretary of State in Georgia, and the courts. Has the threat now breached into those areas too? Or, I mean, these lawsuits that they're clear and the laws that they're passing, because now these are laws passed by legislators. So I think courts treat those differently than some of the shenanigans that the Republicans were up to, like you said, these frivolous cases they have. They're going to have more standing to win some of these? Or, I mean, how far does this go? I mean,
yeah. So I think the way to think about it is that we're not going to dig ourselves out of this anti-democratic mess through litigation. Now, that's a weird thing for me to say, since that's the tool that I bring to bear. You know, litigation is the last resort. It is what you do when the political branches fail. It's what happens when legislatures do the wrong thing or fail to do the right thing. It's what happens when election officials fail to do the right thing or do the wrong thing. The problem is that, you know, as you, I think, allude to, states, by and large, get to set their election rules. Now, I happen to believe that the excesses we've seen in Iowa and in Georgia and in Florida, and Montana and elsewhere, make those laws vulnerable to court challenge. And I think we will win a number of those cases. But we can't count on every bad law being thrown out. You know, at some point, we have to both change the minds of the lawmakers, or have Congress pass federal laws, and we need to change the hearts and minds of the 70% of Republicans who, in a recent poll, said they believe that the 2020 election was illegitimate. So it's a tall order, and you know, I feel sometimes like I am the kid with the thumb in the dike, you know, keeping the water. I
forget, right.
But the water's coming.
How do you bring any of these GOP folks along to support that, given what's going on in their base? And like you said, this sort of growing tide, you know, almost, I mean, they see, I think HR1 is almost, they've said it'd be apocalyptic for them. I mean, how do we get enough votes there?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a good question. I mean, the fact is HR1 would go a long way. It wouldn't solve everything, but it would solve an overwhelming majority of the problems that we're now seeing with these suppressive voting laws. So I think it's really, really important. The question of how you move Republicans, I think it is not realistic to assume that that bill is going to pass with any bipartisan support. So it would have to pass on only Democratic votes.
So the filibuster would have to come into play on that.
Well, yeah. So how do we move the Manchins of the world to get this thing done? Do you think it's just going to be more of these lawsuits and these apocalyptic regulations everywhere, and they finally say, okay, this is worth actually killing the filibuster for?
That I don't know. My sort of role in this, I view as twofold. Number one is to buy time. By hopefully winning litigation to challenge these unconstitutional laws and give the breathing room for Congress to pass federal legislation and for states to come to their senses, for the state legislatures to let this craziness pass beyond them. So number one, I view our role is to bring litigation to vindicate voting rights and buy time for the political process to work. The second is to call attention to it and let people know just how serious a threat this is to our democracy.
So, look, one of the things our listeners can do, obviously, is support Democracy Docket, and we'll put the link to that in our show notes as well. But, you know, what's important for people to know about how they could help or get involved in this fight? Is it calling their legislatures? I mean, is it what can people do out there to help? You know, obviously we got to go register voters, get people out to vote, exercise our ballots. But is there anything they can do in this fight that that would help?
I'm going to say something that I learned from a younger Joe Trippi as a younger Mark Elias, which is, I think we oftentimes overlook the power of neighbor talking to neighbor, friend talking to friend. People standing up in their town square. Now, for you, your town square is quite large. It's a podcast. You go on national television. You can be heard by a lot of people. But you know, part of what we need to do is to change people's view of what does it mean to let everyone vote? What does it mean to a society where you restrict people's vote? And that's going to be done in conversations conversations where people meet up at the local coffee shop, or they knock on each other's door. They speak about it over family dinners with their relatives and agree with them. And so one of the things that I find frustrating is that people ask, what can they do to help? And in some ways, giving money, making phone calls is kind of the easy stuff. The hard stuff is talking to your network, standing up in your town square, and putting yourself out there about how important this is, and not just looking the other way when someone says, oh, we don't want those people to vote. Like, that's your moment to engage, not to disengage.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about that a lot, about getting, not just in your own network, but getting out of our silos and actually talking,
yeah.
You know, actually trying to have a conversation, even if it's, you know, and you get a whole lot of, why would you talk to those Republicans? But it, no, we have to convince that 70%, or, you know, we can convince 10% of them, 20% of them that, you know, that, but it's by talking, it's having the conversations by, and not screaming and, you know, yelling at each other. That's not going to work.
Right. And that's why I don't talk about it in terms of your own networks. I talk about it as your own town square. Because the notion of the town square is there going to be people in the town square who are going to walk by as you're shouting who don't agree with you, right? When you're preaching on the corner, people are going to, strangers or people who are not in your everyday life are going to hear you. So it's not just talking to other people who agree with you. It's talking to people who you have some connection to. That connection may just be you live in the same town. It may be that you went to the same school. It may be that you share a common interest. It may be that they're your relative, but talking honestly with them, they may be your clients, your customers, right? They're people who you can engage and not to shrink away from those conversations. See, that's the thing, Joe, is that too often I think what happens is people are very comfortable having these conversations where they know that everyone agrees with them. But once they're not sure, then they just kind of want to stay away from it.
Not engaged, don't want to start that fight. So there's no need to get into a fight. You can actually have a conversation, hopefully it's the climate of civility too that Trump brought along, but we need to break through that.
Yeah.
What I see it almost, I mean, real fear going into 2022, we've got the whole idea that an incumbent president, only three times in history has actually gained seats or held on to a majority in the House, or didn't lose seats, I mean. So that's there. We have reapportionment in the census where, you know, anywhere, depending on, you know, whether Cook Report or whoever, you can look at, you know, independent folks who see basically Republicans able to draw another, either between 10 or 3 or 4 more safe Republican seats than exist today, all pointing to losing the House of Representatives before you even get into the voter suppression stuff that they do. And that's what I'm saying. Exactly. No,
the elections.
And then the court cases and all this, all these other things. So it really, I go back to that feeling after Biden wins and particularly after the Georgia vote and two senators, Warren and Ossoff, were elected, the sense of relief. And what I'm seeing is even more fear, I mean, me personally, that we've got to be even more engaged. And as you said, in the meantime, the wave on their against after the insurrection keeps growing, to put up these barriers. It just seems like they're still going to push as hard as they can, and we need everybody to realize that 2020, as much as the 2020 may have been a relief, 2022 could be just as bad, if not worse. And so I don't know where you have.
Think about it this way. I wrote this, and I think it's right, but you can put a hole in it if I'm wrong. I think right now you could be considered a member of good standing in the Republican Party and be opposed to free trade or support free trade.
Right.
I think you can be a Republican in good standing support more environmental regulation or oppose more environmental regulation. I think you could even be a Republican in good standing in Congress and support more taxes or oppose taxes. The only thing you can't be in the Republican Party right now is in favor of voting rights. It's literally the fiber that holds their entire party together. And that should be very, very concerning to people who care about democracy. It should be very concerning for those of us focused on the 2022 election, because that is their platform. Like there is no other defining feature to their platform other than this issue. And of course, we've got on our side, we've got a million things going on, right? We've got a lot of things that we are worried about.
Like I said, the Atlantic article said that if we lose the fight to protect voting rights, we'll lose everything else. They think if they don't win the fight to oppose voting rights, they'll lose everything else. I mean, there's nothing left for them.
But I'm not sure our side understands that as deeply as their side is my point.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's what worries me, and why I the show may start to be a little crying into the wind here, because for the last three or four times and one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on as a guest was to make sure that we're starting to deliver this message, that people get how much at risk things really are in 2022. And it's not going to be you in court, or it's all of us having to have these conversations and to start to dismantle this authoritarian, anti-democratic impulse that's out there as much as we can between now and 2022. And I think the only way to do that is to actually talk to have these conversations and for people to get involved locally from the bottom up. I've talked about Ron Brownstein, who has thought a lot about, what's going on politically. But he sort of says that, the Republican Party is stacking sandbags against the tide of history. In other words, it's inevitable that the Southwest, et cetera, will move. And, different demographic groups are moving to the Democratic Party. My worry is that's not going to happen fast enough between 2020. It may happen 6 or 8 years from now, or four, but we may, if you suppress and taken away voting rights, it'll never get there, which is, I guess, what the Republicans have got to be driving them.
Exactly. So I wrote a piece on Democracy Doc, actually, called Consent to the Governed, in which I talk about this, that in 2020, 7 million more Americans voted for a Democrat for president than a Republican, and the election was close. It wasn't super close, but it was close. I forget the number in the Senate, it's in the article, but it's like 20 million more people have voted for Democrats in the current Senate than Republicans, and more, and the same, there's more votes for Democrats in the House than Republicans in the House, state legislatures, governors, right? Like, no matter how you cut it, the Republican Party has now become an anti-majoritarian party. Like, they have increasingly embraced anti-majoritarianism because it is their only way of making, of competing. So remember, go back, because I know you were involved in the 2004 right. election.
I tried to forget that.
Remember, if you remember, George Bush didn't in the 2004 election. You and I both worked hard against George Bush, so we're not apologists for him. But he didn't celebrate the fact that he won in 2000 by not winning the popular vote.
Yes.
Like, that wasn't a point of his pride, right? That was actually kind of a sore point with him, that he wanted to not be the person who lost the popular vote. The Republicans have given up winning the popular vote for president. Like, that is now in the rearview mirror. Their whole way of winning elections moving forward is to let that, what used to be a need to win the majority, to that, then losing by 3 million votes, then moving, losing by 7 million votes. You know, their next plan is to figure out how do we lose right. by 15 million votes and still win. And part of it is, you know, is the rules of the game, but part of it is also figuring out right. how you keep certain people from voting, because that's the other mechanism.
Well, the Senate and the Electoral College work for them, given the way, you know, Idaho has two senators, California has two senators, you know, so and the Electoral College works that way too. But the only way they can make the House is their ability, because of the state legislatures, to redraw lines, change voting rules in the state legislature. And Democrats, we just didn't really focus on a lot of that for too many years. And now that's the last bastion for Republicans, but they have it. And they're using it like there's no tomorrow, because for them, there may not be if they don't suppress votes change the rules and reduce the rights of people to vote, and particularly target the way they do a lot of voters who are lower income and don't have a ability to fight back or fight for their rights or do, but it's often after the election and it's in court and people like you help make that happen. But it's after the horse has left the barn, it's going to be a lot tougher.
Yeah, and look, there was a study that came out that looked at the effect of partisan gerrymandering. And what it found is that this is looking at, I think, 70, 80, 90, 2000, and 2010. So it's looking over time. And what they found is that where Republicans control the entire process, one can expect a 9% vote share advantage for Republicans. Where Democrats control the trifecta, control the entire process, they can expect a 0% partisan advantage. And, you know, that has been the reality of how this has worked. You know, when people talk about both sides of gerrymandering, they're really talking about apples and oranges. You know, I know you're a Marylander. So everyone, you know, always says, yes, but what about Maryland? And the answer is, okay, so there's one seat in Maryland that people say is a Democratic gerrymander. Now let's talk about North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Virginia till very recently, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina. Like, you know, right. this yeah, one seat yeah, in yeah, Maryland yeah. is doing a lot of work.
No, and the other thing is, like, when I look at it, you know, all the states that set up independent commissions, and there are some that have been set up in a Republican state, but for the most part, there's where the Democrats have everything. We create independent commissions to draw the lines. You just don't see that when they have the trifecta. They draw the lines and they get that 8-9% increase in their voter share in those districts by gerrymandering. And so you put that with these oppressive voting rights moves that they're making. What's the most egregious thing you've seen in all the states so far that they've tried to do?
In the voting rights or in the redistricting?
Either one. What's the thing you see?
Well, redistricting is just beginning. So for voting rights, look, I think that there's been a lot of attention paid to the Georgia law, and the Georgia law is a bad law, and I could walk through all the reasons why it is so bad. I'm going to pick Iowa. Iowa actually had relatively, you know, uneventful elections in 2020. You know, there wasn't much that the Republicans could complain about on a partisan outcome basis. The local election officials all celebrated their successes. Secretary of State talked about how wonderful their elections were. The governor praised the elections. There was increased record turnout in the elections. You'd think not much to do here. The state of Iowa, even before Georgia, then went about passing a law that makes voting by mail harder, shortens periods for voting by mail, shortens the period for early voting, and in a twist that we have limits drop boxes, does all the usual stuff that you now see Republicans doing. But then the one that gets me is they also chopped an hour off Election Day. Literally, they shortened Election Day by an hour. And I have to say, in all of my years of practice, I'm trying to remember a state that shortened election day.
Lengthened.
Oh, you've had states that lengthen election
day? Yeah, the lengthening I've seen. I haven't seen shorten either. So.
You know, and so literally they made it harder to vote early, same day, by mail, early. Like it's just, it's a pathology. And it is, it's if you see that in a state like Iowa, which you know pretty well, has a pretty strong culture of not, you know, of not being hyper-partisan around their election administration. It just tells you how far
I've always thought Iowa was one of the fairer places that I've ever worked in. I mean, just the culture of the place and the way people think about it. But it's just amazing.
So, Mark, one of the questions we always get is that mail-in voting piece. And it people always wonder, who does it really hurt? And don't you think it's a little short-sighted in that doesn't this kind of hurt Republicans either more historically than Dems?
You mean the limiting of early voting? Limiting of
vote by mail.
Vote by mail.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things to this. The first is traditionally older white voters.
Sure. Yeah.
On average, I mean, these are obviously only averages, prefer vote by mail relative to younger voters and particularly Black voters. So historically, that is true. However, there are two things to that data that you need to be sort of attentive to. The first is that before 2020, so now I'm talking about 2018 data, right? So before the, because 2020 is, the data is going to be a little hinky because of the pandemic about who prefers what. But in 2018, as you may remember, there was a close election for governor and Senate in the state of Florida. Andrew Gillum lost by 0.4%. Bill Nelson lost by 0.1%. Some academics looked at the rejected mail ballots in that election. And what they found is that if you were 18 to 21 and you voted by mail, you had a 5.4% rate of rejection. If you are over 65, you had a 0.6% chance. So it means one out of every 20 ballots by a young person was thrown in the trash, and one out of every 200 older persons' ballots were not.
And that would have made the difference, though.
And if you were Black, your rate of rejection was twice that if you were white.
Jeez.
So yes, it is true. It is true that vote by mail as a universe previously had been more Republican than Democratic. But when you look at the rules about how those ballots are counted and processed, which is oftentimes what we are all tinkering with here, it's what the legislatures are tinkering with here in Georgia and in Florida. What they're doing is they are taking the edges off of the pieces they are not doing the things that will harm older white voters, and they are sharpening the edges, I should say, to the pieces that will trap younger voters and minority voters.
Right. It's to keep the right people from voting, right? Or the wrong people from voting, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So think of it this way. The two biggest reasons why you see that disparity on age and race are late received ballots. These are ballots that were put in the mail, but didn't arrive on time because Florida requires ballots to be received by election day, not postmarked by election day. So that's one. And then the second is mismatched signatures. And so when you ban ballot drop boxes or limit ballot drop boxes, you are pushing more ballots into the mails, which is going to increase the aggregate number of rejections of young and Black voters and Hispanic voters' ballots, because that's already a disparity that exists. And when you do the changes to signature matching that have been proposed, which were some of the hard-fought victories we had last cycle, were to make these signature matching laws fairer, that's also going to disproportionately negatively impact young voters and voters of color. Although what's interesting about the signature matching, it also seems to have a disproportionately negative impact on women, because they oftentimes, because of maiden names, they get their ballots rejected for mismatching the name.
So, okay, Mark, how does this all end? I mean, how's this How do we get out of this?
Yeah. So look, as I said before, I think the way out of this is through the political branches, right? The way out of this is for Congress to pass HR 1, the For the People Act, also known as S1, and then the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act. So that's one way out of it. The second, though, is to convince the American people on the other side of this, that they should not view voting access as a win-lose proposition, that there is actually something that strengthens communities when we all vote. You know, I know you're in Maryland and I'm in Virginia, but both of us spent enough time in New England to know that one of the charming things is the town meeting, you know, where literally you'll have these town meetings in these small communities throughout Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire, and I think parts of Western Massachusetts, where the town gets together and they will vote on, like, you know, whether to buy another snowplow, you know. And there's something that strengthens the community when everyone is participating in that. And the idea that we are now as a country going about trying to prevent people from participating, that actually weakens the entire community. And getting people to understand that forget about the outcome of the elections, as a process, it strengthens our country when everyone participates. I think that that's how it has to end. If it's going to end well, that's how it's going to end. If we are not successful in doing that, then eventually it won't end well.
Well, Mark, thank you for all your efforts. You can follow Mark's work at democracydocket.com and on Twitter at Mark E. Elias. That's Mark with a C. We'll include those links in our show notes. Mark, you got any other parting shots or questions?
No, just thank you for everything you've done, you're doing on this podcast, and you've done. I'm a big fan.
Thanks, Mark. Well, same here. Right back at you. One thing I do want to check in with Alex on before we end this podcast is the latest in the Cheney GOP soap opera.
Yeah. So, Joe, obviously she's out as of now. They ousted her. And as Mark mentioned earlier, they booed her during the voice vote after she, again, her crime was refusing to side with the big lie and President Trump.
Well, she also said she wanted to make sure he never again gets near the Oval Office. He can't like that. Neither can 70% at least of the Republican Party.
Well, he did. He called, and I never thought I'd see this day, but he called a Cheney
and a warmonger
a major Democrat.
Well, that
unquote, which just Well, that one might be more fair.
She's not her dad, so can't do that to her.
So, meanwhile, we do have kind of this moderate wave of Republicans, like the former DHS guy Miles Taylor, Christine Whitman, Tom Ridge. Haven't heard his name in a while. They're threatening to start a third party. So now all of a sudden it was the Trump side threatening a third party. Now it's the moderates. I mean, is this the moment of reckoning, or are they just going to get rolled over?
Now, look, I think that I don't know about that group. I mean, we'll see. I mean, it's good that 100-150 Republicans have formed a group and, you know, are basically talking about, you know, either leaving the party, starting a new party, or reforming. You know, that's always good. I still think that, and I've been saying this for, I don't know, 3 or 4 shows, that I think Liz Cheney, if she keeps this up, could be the straw that breaks that camel's back over time. I mean, she's not going to be speaker, but she may well be president. Other people are now starting to say that. Because I do think, look, there's going to be a whole bunch of Trump wannabes running for that nomination in 2024. I don't think Trump will be one of them. And so if he isn't running, you'll have 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 10 Trump wannabes running. And she, you know, only need to win those early states with 18, 20, 24. Trump only won Iowa, I think, with 24% of the vote, if I remember right. So she could get there. And I think so
the combination of them throwing her out, somebody who with her who's speaking with, you know, forcefully on this and is, you know, very strong and committed to making the fight, with a bunch of other Republicans, you know, forming this group to start and threatening to start a third party. We'll see if they actually do that. But I do think I think Cheney's the most important event. I mean, I think what is going on with her, because of who she is and the way she's bringing the fight without any backing down, that's something that I think could continue to grow. And strength like that tends, and by the way, we saw this with Trump, that people respond, starts to bleed people to their into their direction. And so, look, there are Republicans out there who are tenuously hanging on to the Trump side of things, but can she break some off and start to grow it the way Trump did it in the opposite direction in 2016, excuse me. I think that's a real important piece to keep looking at and watching. And I know people say, well, that's scary. I can't believe you're rooting for Liz Cheney. I am rooting for any Republicans who are trying to talk truth to power, and the power is their base right now, knowing that that means possible the end of their careers. There's a bunch of Republican consultants that I respect who put it all on the line when they started the Lincoln Project, and Liz Cheney, others who were like, you know, rushed out of the House or the Senate or retired because they knew their days were numbered in the parties that exist. All of them, we shouldn't be pushing them away from us. We should be pulling them in there and working together to stop this authoritarian, anti-democratic threat. Thanks for listening to That Trippy Show. We'll be back next Friday. As usual, if you have a race you want us to spotlight or a question, please submit it on iTunes in the reviews or email us at thattrippyshow@gmail.com. See you next Friday, and check the show notes for ways to follow Mark, and check out the piece in the New Republic article that I mentioned earlier. Thank you.